Hello, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR News. I'm web producer Andrew Prince. In this week's Science Highlights, we'll go for a run with an evolutionary biologist to learn why humans were built to go the distance. Human evolution is also affecting other species. We'll hear how ants are changing their behavior thanks to our growing cities. Also, we'll find out how a molecular archaeologist recreated an ancient beer and wintering on Mars. But first, our series on evolution, The Human Edge. Last week, we heard how humans came to walk on two legs. Now, we'll learn how far and how fast those legs can carry us. To find out more, NPR's Christopher Joyce went for a jog.
So how far should we go?
Dan Lieberman starts running toward a bridge.
We could either go that way, that's about a mile and a half, or we can go that way, that's about a mile.
A rather distant bridge.
If you want to abandon ship, that's fine. I don't blame you. It's not...
He looks like a human greyhound. Lieberman's already run 3 miles this morning. He's an evolutionary biologist at Harvard University, and he studies running and how it makes humans unique. Even when he's running a marathon, he's thinking about how the body does it.
Sometimes I do kind of bizarre things when I'm running and, you know, move my arms in funny ways to just to think about it, and I get these strange looks and realize I should probably not be doing this in public.
Today, it's his footwear that draws attention. They're like gloves, skin tight, no heels, no support. Lieberman studies barefoot runners and finds they naturally land on the balls of their feet. It's too painful to land on the heel. Planting your foot on the ball transfers and stores elastic energy in the foot ligaments and the Achilles tendon.
And then those, they act like rubber bands, the springs, and they recoil and they push you back up into the air as you start to take your jump.
Lieberman says that makes barefoot running, the way our ancestors ran, more efficient than running with shoes. But even if early humans ran more efficiently, they still couldn't run as fast as a four-legged mule. So, Lieberman says, they evolved into marathon machines.
Most animals are designed for speed, for power, not for endurance. And we're a very special species in having been selected for endurance, not speed.
We grew longer legs and lighter feet. The joints in the legs and the pelvis got bigger to absorb a lot of impact. We grew a bigger butt muscle. Lieberman says these and other changes allowed us to run down and exhaust prey, like antelope and kudu. He notes that so-called persistence hunters in Africa have been known to do that. And the payoff would have been big for early humans. Lots of high-calorie meat to feed a bigger brain. At this point, my brain is oxygen-starved, so we stop running. Lieberman says I lack meat motivation.
In fact, I tell people, you know, when you're in the marathon and you're wondering at mile 16 or 17 what on earth you're doing, remember, you're chasing a kudu. That's what you're doing. You're reenacting that chase from a million years ago.
Does it work?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, going in 3, 2, 1.
At Harvard's 19th Century Peabody Museum, one of Lieberman's graduate students runs on a treadmill. Electrodes stuck on his body record muscle contractions. He wears a dog collar around his forehead with accelerometers to measure head movements. Lieberman is creating a computer model of how we run. He thinks it will tell him how the earliest humans evolved to run. He believes running made us what we are. To prove it, he sometimes asks his volunteer runners to do some strange things.
There are no humans out there with faces as large as Neanderthals, so people wear weights in their mouths, which then changes the center of gravity of the head.
They put weights in their mouth?
Oh, yeah, so we have special weights.
It sounds horrible.
Yes, it is.
But understanding head control is important. If you don't keep your head still, you can't focus your eyes. Lieberman says modern humans, unlike apes, have a special muscle that connects each arm to the neck and the head. When you swing your arms, they become counterweights to stabilize the head. Clearly, we're runners. And millions of years ago, we started putting more meat on our menus. That's clear from cut marks on animal bones and our unique digestive system and our bigger brain. Did endurance running make that happen? Lieberman thinks yes, though the proof is tough to tease out.
When you find bones, they they, you know, none of them come with labels on them telling you how they ran or how they walked or why they're the way they are in the first place or why we are the way we are, right? But they pose questions about, you know, what were the transitions in human evolution? Why did those anatomical features change?
Some scientists say just because modern African hunters can run down prey doesn't prove our ancestors did. There's no hard evidence of it. Maybe it was better hunting tools that got us more meat. Maybe what Lieberman sees as the body's running adaptations just made for better walking. And some suspect that Lieberman's passion for running colors his conclusions. He says no.
Oh, I'm an evolutionary biologist first, and a runner second, absolutely. I mean, I do love running, but it's not the only thing I love.
Lieberman is passionate about exercise. He says it's fundamental to being human. It's essential to the way our bodies function and to keep them healthy. He says running is the purest form of exercise.
Adding information about how exercise, how we evolved to exercise, and how exercise is actually woven into our bodies by natural selection in a special way, I think adds extra relevance.
Especially, he says, as our modern lifestyle threatens to make human exercise obsolete. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Be sure to check out other stories in this Human Edge series at our website, npr.org/science. And now, a story about how another species is evolving. Ants invade homes all over the country, but entomologists have noticed that one species has developed a special affinity for cities. From member station WAMU in Washington, Sabri Benishour has more.
This is a story about a party girl. Her name is Cecily, and her story is an old one, really. She moved from the country to the city and totally reinvented herself. She got caught up in the glitz and glam of urban life, and now she's dead in my friend Aaron's apartment.
It was really scary.
Cecily, scientists call her Tapanoma Cecily, is also known as the odorous house ant. You know the small brown ant you find in your kitchen? Yeah, that's probably her. Ant colonies are almost entirely female. She started crashing Aaron's parties last winter.
Just everywhere. And even on the floors everywhere you looked, you swarms of ants. I mean, the
over the
kitchen.
Past few decades, this ant has adapted to city life in a major way.
They're our number one pest.
Wayne White is an entomologist with American Pest, a pest control company in Tacoma Park, Maryland. He and many other scientists say Cecily is becoming a dominant urban species.
You know, 20 years ago, I don't believe we had nearly the calls about odorous house ants. Now, we would have had still a large number of calls about ants, but there were different kinds of ants.
White dumps a jar of them out onto the table at his office to show me how to identify this type of ant.
I'm going to let a couple of these guys out here.
White holds up his finger, smeared with ant paste, and we take a whiff.
It smells kind of like blue cheese and coconut.
Okay.
Not a bad smell, just not what I expected ants to smell like. But that's how you know it's Cecily. Smell is also how Cecily knows it's Cecily. Ants, it's believed, use smell to recognize whether or not they belong to the same colony. To demonstrate this, White pulls out two vials of ants, each from different sides of the building, probably different nests.
Let's see what happens here. If we just dump a few in there, what do you think?
These ants should be at war if they're from different colonies. But they're not. They're actually pretty calm, like they know each other. And remember, these ants were collected at least 100 feet apart. That means their colony could be really big. That is a far cry from what Cecily does in nature.
In nature, there'll be just a small colony with a queen and maybe 50 workers, and they might live in an acorn in the forest.
But in the city, they form massive super colonies with thousands of queens and millions of workers. And not just in Washington. It's happening in Tennessee, Colorado, Utah, Indiana. One study at Purdue University found one super colony that spanned an entire city block. Sean Mankey is a research fellow at North Carolina State University. He recently wrote a paper on Cecily.
Urban populations that we've seen are thousands, possibly even tens of thousands times larger than the largest thing I've ever found in a natural environment. So it is on a completely different scale.
He also noticed Cecily is behaving more aggressively in the city.
It's expressing something at least in some areas, very differently than anything anybody's ever found in a more natural type of habitat.
So basically, buried in the DNA of this little ant is a time bomb. Given the right conditions, which it turns out don't seem to occur very commonly in nature, it can change its behavior and form these massive supercolonies. There's a word for this in science. It's called phenotypic plasticity, the ability of an individual to change its traits in order to adapt to its environment. But Menke says that raises the question, what in the city is driving Cecily to change?
If you think of an urban area as we basically knocked down the forest or the grassland and built a whole new environment, so you start out with zero species in there. The first thing that gets in has no predators, no parasites, and no competitors.
That's one possibility. The other is that
we've just made a buffet table for them.
In nature, they don't come across high fructose corn syrup too often, or sheltered basements with year-round heating. Scientists don't know yet which it is for Cecily, the abundance of food or the new environment. Nor do scientists know why now. Is it the expansion of cities, climate change, undetected genetic changes? They don't know. But as they try to answer all the questions that Cecily raises, they'll learn more about what makes a species invasive. For now, they just know Cecily has a new urban attitude and loves a good party. She was so shy. For NPR News, I'm Sabri Benishore in Washington.
Let's leave the summer heat for a minute and go somewhere a little cooler, the Gusev crater on Mars. It's winter there, and Spirit, one of NASA's twin robotic rovers, has gone into a deep sleep. But back on Earth, scientists are eagerly awaiting to see whether Spirit will survive the cold and dark. Joe Palca recently visited the rover control room at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena.
Winter is always a tough time for a solar-powered outpost on Mars. Days are short, the sun is low on the horizon, and it's cold. Really cold. More than 60 degrees below zero.
And that's colder than the rover has ever been on Mars.
John Callis is mission manager for NASA's rover program.
Now, the rover was tested to that temperature here on the ground, but that was 7 years ago with a brand new rover. This is a rover that's quite senior.
And this was a mission that was intended to last 90 days, not 7 years. In previous winters, the rover used battery-powered heaters to keep warm. But this year, those heaters are shut off to save energy. Two reasons for that. One, the rover's been stuck in the sand for more than a year with its solar panels not pointing in the best direction. And two, those solar panels are covered with Martian dust, so they're not as efficient at recharging the rover's batteries. That's why engineers let Spirit enter a deep sleep mode for the winter.
When Spirit will wake up is very uncertain right now.
It will only wake up when the days get longer and the solar panels are able to recharge the batteries. Callis says they've made a computer model to predict when that will be.
That model predicts that the rover might wake up sometime around the late September, early October timeframe.
But Callis says the model's calculations are based on several assumptions, so it may not be very accurate.
The rover could wake up tomorrow if temperatures are warmer than we expected. That's why we've been listening every day. We have been listening every day for some time now.
If it does wake up, its roving days are likely over. Two of its six motorized wheels have stopped working, and mission managers are not optimistic about getting it rolling again. But Callis says if Spirit does wake up, it still makes a great weather station and can help with experiments designed to understand the planet's core. On the other side of Mars, Spirit's twin rover Opportunity is in much better shape. It also uses solar arrays for power, and it also has a lot of dust on those arrays. But every once in a while, Opportunity gets lucky.
Recently, we had a cleaning event on Opportunity. Part of the dust on the solar arrays was blown off by some sort of a wind event. And now we have a lot more power, and we can drive almost every day at this point.
Opportunity is on its way to a large crater called Endeavour. Scientists hope to find very old rock formations there. Opportunity started its 12-mile trek to the crater 2 years ago, and it's about halfway there.
As we get closer to Martian summer, we should be able to drive longer and longer each day.
Some of the instruments on Opportunity are showing signs of age, but Callis won't make any predictions about when its mission will end. Why should he?
We're going to keep going until the rover stops.
And at least for now, that day still seems a long way off. Joe Palca, NPR News.
The Germans, the Belgians, and the Czechs have been making beer for centuries. But it turns out that the ancient Chinese brewed beer as well. NPR producer Brad Horn has this story about decoding a 9,000-year-old beer recipe.
Chateau Jiahu is a time capsule from 7,000 BC. But to hear Dogfish head owner Sam Calagione talk about what beer was actually like back then, it's not really the kind of thing that makes you say, hey, pass me another ice-cold ancient ale.
Probably all beer thousands of years ago to our modern palates would have tasted spoiled. In fact, people would drink it out of a straw, and that's because they were trying to avoid the chunks of solids and wild yeast and stuff that was in it.
So how do you go from chunks of wild yeast to a beer that you can get at your local store? You don't start with Sam Calagione or Dogfish Head Brewery. You start with Dr. Patrick McGovern.
I'm the scientific director of the Biomolecular Archaeology Laboratory at the University of Pennsylvania Museum.
Who, like he said, is a biomolecular archaeologist. He studies fermented beverages, in other words, booze, by analyzing the pots that held the drinks thousands of years ago.
So we use techniques like infrared spectrometry, mass spectrometry, and so forth.
Dr. McGovern helps Dogfish Head revive long-dead brews using modern tools to figure out what used to be in the ancient pottery he comes across. About 10 years ago, he set out to find some of this primordial crockery on a trip to China.
Well, I went to a town called Zhengzhou, where they had all the pottery collected from this early Neolithic site.
Which translates to pottery that's about 9,000 years old, and it was found in a burial ground next to 9,000-year-old skeletons. The Neolithic period started about 12,000 years ago, and is thought to be when humans started doing things like settling down, raising crops, and apparently getting a little tipsy. Dr. McGovern thinks that when humans stayed in one place long enough, they were able to discover the process of fermentation that led to the world's first alcohol. The Chinese archaeologists allowed Dr. McGovern to bring the ancient pots back to Philadelphia with him.
And then we began doing our analyses.
Where he uncovered molecular evidence that the vessels contained an alcoholic beverage made of rice, grapes, hawthorn berries, honey, and chrysanthemum flowers.
What we found was something that was turning up all over the world from these very early periods, is that we don't have just a wine or a beer or a mead, but we have like a combination of all three.
And this is where Dogfish Head comes in. Dogfish owns a tiny but respected sliver of the U.S. beer market, just 1/20 of 1%, according to Calagione. And they've earned that sliver by being risk takers. Dogfish has produced other ancient brews with Dr. McGovern, like their Midas Touch beer, which is based on molecular analysis of pottery found in what is claimed to be King Midas's 2,700-year-old tomb. But like Calagione says, Jiahu is different.
It's the oldest known fermented recipe in the history of mankind.
So Calagione and Dogfish brewers set out to recreate what might just be the world's first alcoholic beverage. The biggest difference between what Neolithic humans probably drank and what you can buy today is that Jiahu contains barley malt, which makes it more commercially viable, less grog-like, more beer-like. At the Dogfish Brewery, surrounded by giant tanks of beer, Calagione and brewer Brian Selder are making Jiahu by pouring bucketfuls of fermentables into a shiny 10,000-gallon tank.
It's rice and malt. Makes
rice,
up the
malt, honey, grapes, hawthorn fruit.
Correct.
Which is brought to a boil and then left to ferment for a month. This year, Dogfish Head will brew about 3,000 cases of Jiahu, a small batch by commercial brewing standards. At $13 for a wine-sized bottle, Jiahu is about 6 times the cost of Budweiser. But Calagione is actually seeing sales of Jiahu and his other specialty brews increase during the recession.
In this economy, a person probably can't treat themselves, the average person, to a new SUV or a new vacation home, but they can surely afford to trade up to world-class beer.
Jiahu isn't cheap, especially for a beer, but it's a lot cheaper than a plane ticket to Neolithic China. Brad Horn, NPR News.
And finally, we take a moment to remember climatologist Stephen Schneider. Here's All Things Considered host Michelle Norris.
One of the foremost experts on climate change has died. Stanford University professor Stephen Schneider suffered an apparent heart attack as he traveled from Stockholm to London. He was 65 years old. Over the years, Schneider won many fellowships and awards. He was on the team with Al Gore that won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. And he was skilled at communicating scientific nuance in plain language. He talked about that earlier this year on NPR's Science Friday.
What I've been so annoyed about is this dumbing down polarization into kind of end of the world and good for you extremes, all have PhDs. How can the public be anything but confused? In fact, end of the world and good for you, the two lowest probability outcomes.
Schneider also applied his skills to his fight against mantle cell lymphoma. The result was a book called The Patient from Hell, How I Worked with My Doctors to Get the Best Modern Medicine and How You Can Too. John Holdren is a science advisor to President Obama. He was a friend and colleague of Schneider's for nearly 40 years.
Steve would come up with crucial insights that really opened up whole new dimensions of research in climate science. One of his big contributions was that the influences that humans were having on climate was not just the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane and others, but our influence also included the effects of particles. And he was sometimes criticized for being too extreme, but in fact he was very middle of the road. Steve was as fierce in his criticism of people who he thought were overstating what we know about climate as he was in his criticisms of those he thought were understating.
It's interesting. At one point, he was a proponent of global cooling. What led to the switch?
In the early 1970s, everybody was in doubt as to the outcome of the competition between the cooling effects of particles and, on the other hand, the warming effect of greenhouse gases. And it was only with the emergence of additional data and additional analysis that it became clear that the greenhouse gases were going to win this competition. And at that point, he was one of the first to point out that, in fact, overall, we were heading for a much hotter world.
The title of his book, The Patient from Hell, did that in part explain his approach to research, his tenacity, and how he decided to try to attack this rare disease he battled?
Steve always wanted to find what the answer was, whether it was climate science or the science behind the health problems that afflicted him, and participated fully in the choices that were being made about his care. I think he saved his own life. I think he saved some other lives of people who were afflicted with the same malady and who ended up embracing, at his advice, the course of treatment that he undertook. And it was just typical of his approach to everything.
Did he apply the same sort of fervor and tenacity to his private pursuits, playing the guitar, doing things like that?
He was an extremely high-energy person. I hiked with Steve Schneider. I fished with Steve Schneider. He was always the most entertaining and interesting companion you could have because he was noticing everything around him, making insightful comments about it, and at the same time just having a heck of a good time.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your insights about your former colleague. All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
That was John Holdren. He's advisor to President Barack Obama and director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy.
That's it for On Science this week. For more science stories, check out our website at npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince, and thanks for listening.